everybody. This is Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks Podcast. Today is October 11th, 2012. And the purpose of today's cast was really just to make an announcement. But who wants just an announcement? Am I right? So I've included a little extra material for you today. Actually, about an hour and 15 minutes of extra material. And the announcement was, I posted this on Facebook and I sent out an email to all of the subscribers to the show saying I needed to take about a three-week break to deal with some private matters. But I realized that between those two channels, I had only reached about 1,000 people and we have more listeners than that. In fact, we had a very good month in September, like 70, 75,000 downloads, which might be one of our best months ever. That was easy to say. Best months ever. How's that? I'm on a temporary setup here as well, so this is not my good mic, and might be a little whistly and a little plosive-y. I have also noticed, as I've gone back and edited a lot of these live shows, I have got one pair of smacky lips, don't I? Anyway, that's the announcement, but a lot of new people coming into the show, so I wanted to be able to provide something, and what you're going to hear today is actually an unreleased live show from August 2nd, 2012. So if you happen to listen live, I'm sorry, but a very, very small percentage of the entire audience actually listens to the show live. So I think this is going to be new for most people. The reason why I didn't release it, well, there's two reasons. First of all, it didn't really accomplish the goals that I had at the beginning of the night for the show that night. So what we wound up doing, Corey and I, is we did an after show where I read a listener email, and it's called How Do I Teach My Child? It's within the last 10 episodes. But this show was kind of all over the place, so that's why it has the word potpourri in the title. And the other thing was there were several technical challenges, mostly related to Ustream, and I felt like I was a little distracted. I think it's still an okay show. I think you'll enjoy listening to it, but it just didn't do what I wanted to do on that night for the goals of the podcast. So while there's this time off, I wanted people to be able to have something, and I wanted to check in and make sure everyone knew what was going on, if you've been waiting for a show. And you might be saying, Brett, I have like 20 shows, so get over yourself. I won't. I like this show. I like School Sucks. So if you do too, I hope you find this satisfying. We should return either a week from today. That'll be next Thursday. What's that? The 18th. And if we're not back on the 18th, we will definitely, definitely be back on the 25th. So that's about it. Hope you enjoy this. And thank you for listening. And if you're new, thank you for discovering School Sucks Podcast and giving it a chance. I really appreciate that. I look forward to your feedback. And we'll see you live. Hopefully very soon. Take care. Everybody, and welcome to School Sucks Live. This is Brett. I'm sitting here by myself tonight in a big empty room in front of this big empty table. I could put six people at this table. We could have the most chaotic radio show in America. But for right now, it's just me, and I'd be happy to hear from you. We can do kind of an open phones thing tonight. My number is 843-JOIN-SSP. You can also Skype in School Sucks Live. And like I said, I'd like to hear from you. I have a couple things I want to discuss tonight, but I actually need some advice too on a situation, conflict I currently found myself involved in. And it has to do with something that happened on Facebook. Yep. People can even have problems with others on Facebook, if you could believe such a thing. So before we go to the phones, I just want to fill you in on what has been going on in the show. In the last week, I started a series, what's going to be the first segment of the show from now on, and we are going to call it Getting to Know Your Cognitive Biases. And you might be saying, Brett, I don't even know what that is. Well, what is a cognitive bias? I'm taking this from Cognitive Biases, a visual study guide. You can find this on scrib.com. I'll put a link to it in the show notes as well. Cognitive biases are psychological tendencies that cause the human brain to draw incorrect conclusions. Such biases are thought to be a form of cognitive shortcut, often based upon rules of thumb, and include errors in statistical judgment, social attribution, and memory. These biases are the common outcome of human thought and often drastically skew the reliability of anecdotal and legal evidence. The phenomenon is studied in cognitive sciences and social psychology. Now, why are we doing this? Well, I think that part of the function of this show is to help everybody become, you know, through their own effort, a better thinker, and also better at persuading others when talking about issues that tend to be controversial or upsetting or go nowhere. You know the topics. So cognitive biases are useful, and I guarantee that you know a couple understanding them. I'm thinking the most common one is called confirmation bias. And I always talk to my students about this. I actually finished an SAT class just this morning. Had a lovely group of six students. I had a few problems with it. It wasn't perfect, and we're probably going to talk about that on the show today. But whenever we're talking about persuasive writing, one of the things that kids tell me that they're being told in these schools is that they'll be given an assignment to do some kind of writing project, and their teacher will say to them, pick a thesis, come up with a thesis, and then go do research. Well, this is madness, folks. We do research and then we come to conclusions. We do research and then we form opinions. Because if we do it the other way, if we decide how we want to feel about something, and then we go out and look for information that will help us feel that way, well, we could wind up believing anything. The example that I always give in the class, I know I've talked about this on the show before, is the hollow earth that aliens live inside. Sometimes I say we live inside and the stars are just cities on other side, the other side. I don't believe this. But someone on the internet will help me believe it if I really want to. That's cognitive bias. And our entire mainstream media is set up around helping people feed their cognitive biases. Fox News, The New York Times, MSNBC. So that's probably the most common example of cognitive biases. Last week, we talked about suggestibility, the quality of being inclined to accept and act on the suggestions of others. So even though there's over 100 cognitive biases, and we're going to be using the first segment of this show for the next probably 2 years to go through, if not all of them, most of them, I wanted to start with a special section called memory biases. There's really four categories: social biases, memory biases, decision-making biases, and probability and belief biases. So right now we are dealing with memory biases. Our first one was suggestibility. And here is the more specific definition for suggestibility: to be affected by a communication or expectation such that certain responses are overtly enacted or subjectively experienced without volition, as in automatism. I always have trouble with that word. Two, deliberately to use one's imagination or employ strategies to bring about effects, even if interpreted eventually as involuntary in response to a communication or expectation. Three, to accept what people say consciously, but uncritically. Imagine that. And to believe or privately accept what is being said. Four, to conform overtly to expectations or the views of others without the appropriate private acceptance or experience. That is, to exhibit behavioral compliance without private acceptance or belief. It's good to have some vocabulary for this. And first of all, to understand that these cognitive errors exist, that we are susceptible to them, that other people are susceptible to them. And maybe understanding this helps us develop more patience, more empathy, and ultimately helps us become better communicators as we are able to recognize that this is something that others are prone to and we are prone to ourselves. Just quickly here, before we go to the phones, I want to mention another one called reminiscence bump. That's a nice name. Reminiscence bump is the tendency for older adults to have increased recollections for events that occurred during their adolescence and early childhood. It was identified through the study of autobiographical memory and the subsequent plotting of the age of encoding of memories to form the lifespan retrieval curve. Now, I'm looking at a chart here that you can't see, but I can describe it to you. There's a period that ends at about age 10 called the period of childhood amnesia, where the number of memories that a person is able to recall by the time they reach age 50 is very, very few compared to, well, the period of recency, which is about 35 on, and this reminiscence bump. And even though these memories are not recent, from the period about age 10 to about age 30, when most stuff in life happens, that is a period where people's memories seem to work overtime. And my understanding of it is because so much stuff, you know, is happening then. Let's think about it. You know, all kinds of novel experiences, getting a driver's license, having some sex, getting a job, going to college. It all happens in that period. So I guess the way the memory works is it makes more space because there is more activity. A quote from an article that I read says, the research shows that between the ages of 16 and 21, the human brain is at its peak and soaks up experiences like a sponge. Now, this is troubling, just like suggestibility was troubling, because it says that people in these emotional states are more prone to uncritically accepting the suggestions of others. We're not going to turn every one of these into some paranoid conspiracy. But while we do understand that those early years of our lives, maybe from 2 to 5, are very formative emotionally, those ages from 16 to 21 are very formative intellectually. And this is when people are, you know, the high school stuff is really being piled on. And that's also the age where most people go to college. And a lot of bad information comes along during that time. I also found a little article on Freakonomics.com called The Reminiscence Bump, Who's Your Favorite Footballer? And I just want to share a study that came from the BPS Research Digest blog that's reported here on Freakonomics. 619 people, aged 16 to 80, took part in the online study conducted in Dutch and hosted on the website of the University of Amsterdam. Participants were presented with the names of 190 all-time leading football players and asked to name their judgment of the 5 best players of all time. They could either select from the list or choose their own. The researchers calculated the mid-career point of the 172 players named by the participants and compared this against the participants' age at that time. Participants overwhelmingly tended to name players whose career midpoint coincided with the participants' teens and early 20s. The modal age of the participants at their chosen... Oh, we got to take a break. I can't hear my bumper music. That's very interesting. We will be back in a minute. This is School Sucks Live, and I'll try to resolve that. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to School Sucks Live. This is Brett sitting here by myself, but I've got all kinds of connections to the outside world. I've got a phone number. It's 843-JOIN-SSP. I also have a Skype, and I've got a gentleman on Skype right now. His name is Sydney, and he is up in Canada. He's actually the host of a podcast called Gaming and Liberty. I've had him on the show before, and here he is again. Sydney, how you doing?
Hey, Brett. I'm doing really good.
Excellent. What's on your
mind? I'm a little nervous.
Why are you nervous?
I'm used to having hours to edit my brain farts out.
Oh, don't worry about it. It's a good way to practice editing less by being on live radio and feeling like you can't screw up. But it's okay if you do, because everyone's on your side anyway, and it's just fine. So don't even worry about it.
Thank you. So yeah, basically, I was listening to schools. I'm hearing myself in my ears for some reason.
Yeah, you might hear yourself a little bit, and I can try to work on that. Evening of technical challenges. I actually had a fire tonight. Also.
Oh my God.
Yep, one of my studio lamps caught on fire. So. I'm working out the kinks, but
excellent.
If you feel like you can go on, then
yes, I can.
Okay.
So basically, I was in my car listening to School Sucks 151, and you were talking about World of Warcraft and behaviorism, and it was funny because that Cracked article that you read, I had been aware of it for a while, and it was, it's pretty funny. My relationship with, behaviorism and game design, because right now, I'm not in video games anymore, but, my background is in, programming, and I worked in, video games. And I had ambitions to become a game designer, right? And I still do, actually. That's not dead yet. Moving on, the tricks that you learn to keep your player engaged in your game kind of involve behaviorism, because the bottom line is, within the world of the game, the only thing you have to offer the player is a carrot or a stick.
Right.
So, concerning World of Warcraft, you know, with the different reward schedules that that there are. I've never played World of Warcraft myself, but a game that I play a lot of is online first-person shooters in general, mainly Call of Duty and Battlefield. And something interesting that they do in this game, which they kind of simulate a random reward schedule. You know how monsters in World of Warcraft, monsters drop goodies at random.
Well, yeah, so, and sure, this goes back to the 80s of these monsters dropping goodies randomly.
And since they drop them randomly, that's what keeps the little rat in the Skinner box pulling the lever to see when he's going to get his next pellet.
Right.
Now, what happens in online shooters like Call of Duty is that instead of having a random reward schedule, you have a whole bunch of fixed ratio reward schedules. And just by playing the game and shooting other players and stuff like that, you can't help but to be pulling on all sorts of levers at the same time. But the thing is, you wanted to say something?
No, go ahead.
Okay, sorry. Anyway, so let's say I'm working on my character or whatever, and I've unlocked some weapons and leveled them up and whatever. And I decide that I want to start this new gun and start leveling it up. Now, when you start a new gun, you get bonuses at fixed intervals. So you usually get a bonus at 10 kills, then 25, then 50, then 75, 150. You get the idea. 300, right. 500. So the idea is you always know how many times you have to pull the lever to get the next pellet. But the thing is, there's so many levers that while I'm leveling up my my new weapon, and let's say I want to get to 150 kills with it, and while I'm doing that, all of a sudden I get extra bonuses like, you've shot 500 players while crouched, you've survived 300 grenade explosions, and stuff like that. And as you're working on the lever that you're really focusing on, all these random goodies in the form of experience and things like that, that you unlock more gear and yada, yada, yada. They cross your way, and it kind of simulates a random reward schedule with a whole bunch of, fixed levers, basically. And I thought that was, an interesting variable on the, WoW model.
So could we describe that, if I'm understanding you correctly, and maybe I'm not, as the sort of reinforcement schedule overload, where you can just become overwhelmed with all these encouragers that keep you doing the thing, pushing the lever?
Well, it really depends. I mean, let's just say it would take a hell of a coincidence for you to get a whole bunch of goodies at the same time, but sometimes it happens. Right. Let's say, I don't know. Here's an example. Let's say I want to work on assault rifles and I want to get 150 kills on 3 assault rifles. Well, as I'm working 150 kills each, I'm also working on kills with overall assault rifles. So when I reach 150 kills with the second assault rifle, I'm also going to get 300 kills with assault rifles. You understand what I'm saying?
Yes.
So in those kinds of coincidences can happen, but it's relatively rare, and it comes in, it really feels like monsters dropping goodies. And the thing is, in these particular shooters, the only thing that you unlock is extra XP that's going to level you up faster and therefore unlock more gear, etc. The experience bonuses are the goodies that the monster's unlocking. And the monster is other human beings that are also doing the same thing and pulling on their own levers and things like that. Although I know you can play versus other players in World of Warcraft.
Yes, yeah. I don't know too much about the game, and I'm not much of a gamer myself at all. So, you know, you have professional experience with this, and you also do a podcast where you share your expertise about this with other people. When we read the Cracked article, it was kind of like, you know, this is Cracked, so take it with a grain of salt. But did you agree? I'm sure you had seen that article before. Did you agree with their general assessments of, you know, game makers today and probably sometime into the past?
Let me tell you the first thing that popped into my mind when you asked me that question.
Sure.
The first time I read that Cracked article, I was at work. So that joke in the article really made me laugh. But having read similar articles to the one that was, how can I say? I've read other articles on behaviorism and game design, not that particular one. So I was kind of aware of what to expect. And the fact that it was a Cracked article, you know, like you said, they do some good stuff. And I think it's, how can I say? I think it's accurate, but it's dangerous to draw conclusions as to the intentions of why these people are doing it, you know?
Yeah, and in mass like that. I mean, I thought it was interesting because, you know, one of the things that we've talked about frequently on the show before is how the scientific management of human beings has kind of bled into all aspects of mainstream culture. So, Sydney, we have to take a break. I'll hold on to you for another segment if you like. This is School Sucks Live. We will be right back. Hey, everybody, and welcome back to School Sucks Live. This is Brett. With me in the studio now is Corey. Oh, I got to fix all kinds of problems with your shot.
Oh, boy.
Weird. Anyway,
one of those things is that I'm in it.
Corey just arrived. And, Corey, you are your timing is perfect tonight because we have Sydney Rock on the phone. Sydney is the host of a podcast called Gaming and Liberty, and he had called in at the beginning of the last segment to discuss the episode we did a couple shows back about behaviorism and video games. Sydney, still with us?
Yes. Yes, I am.
All right. So we can pick up where we left off. We were just talking about my assessment of how all of this stuff has bled into society and behaviorism. I mean, even though this movement is less than 120 years old, if you go back to maybe John B. Watson or Willem Wundt before him, it is like the water we are in as fish. It is very pervasive in our society. So we were talking about how this comes into video games, but you know, this, even though it might not be all throughout video games, we were pretty focused on World of Warcraft in the last show. We see it, we see other things, and from your experience, maybe you could tell us more about how video games are being used for different types of conditioning, propaganda. Anything like that?
Well, was that for me or Sid or both?
That's an open question. That's okay. A question open to the panel here.
Well, I don't know how this, you know, how strictly this applies to behaviorism in video games, but I know that the U.S. Army, for example, is not ashamed of using video games as a recruiting tool.
Yeah, and Sid, this is something that we talked about. We've seen these kiosk or these, what are those old things called that people
use? I think it's
arcade cabinets?
America's Army. Army.
Yeah.
I forget what the name of that game is, but yeah, it's like, they don't even like, how can I say? It's openly a recruiting tool. And, it's deviously clever. And if it wasn't used for, an institution like, the U.S. military or any other military, really, it's not, specific to any country. I would kind of respect the deviousness, but used for such a purpose kind of makes my spine shiver.
Violence, killing people is fun. And
yes, it's fun when it's digital. That's right. The thing. Like Corey plays World of Warcraft, which is one of the popular games. I play more Call of Duty, which is the other one that's often mentioned when we're talking about video games and its relationship to us and society and violence, etc. I mean, I enjoy that stuff, but as long as it's virtual and, you know, I think if someone got shot in front of me, I would freak out and need to, you know.
Yeah.
Get over that for a couple of days, etc.
I think if I was ever actually in a situation like Call of Duty, but in real life, I would be like that guy in Saving Private Ryan, who was just like always on the verge of collapsing because he just couldn't mentally handle being in combat. That's the guy I would be.
Yeah.
But I can fake it in a video game quite well, especially if I'm pretending to be an alien or something.
So it's better when a person doesn't lie there gasping for breath with blood pouring out of them. It's better when after 5 seconds they just kind of disappear and there's a coin where they were,
mm-hmm.
or some kind of bag of some kind of item you're trying to collect. That's better.
Yes,
preferable.
It may actually help also if there are so many people shooting at you and you don't know even what any of them might look like that you don't have time to watch the corpse slowly have the life drain out of it.
Yeah. Well, I think more generally speaking here, it's just really a matter of time when we see how popular video games have become mm-hmm. over the last 20 years. It would only be a matter of time until people started to try and use them, perfect them for all kinds of nefarious purposes. But, you know, I've been more than happy. This is one of the things that I wanted to get into on the show today, talking about was that video games can also be wonderful teaching tools for young people. Sydney, I don't know if you heard my Tribe tragedy story. But
yes, I remember that. I felt so bad for those children.
Yeah, it was quite a day. But other than that, really negative experience where if you didn't hear that show, I was playing. I have found this game called My Tribe where you can build a civilization, and I was doing it with 6 to 8 year old kids at the school called the Scholars Academy. The problem is that one of the behaviorist aspects to video games is they keep you on the lever, right, Corey?
That was right. One of they keep you pressing that button. Whether you think food's going to come out or not, you press it just in case.
So if you don't press it, just like the Skinner box had an electric grid that would shock the rat to get it to press the lever again, mm-hmm. if you are out of your game for too long, bad things start to happen.
Right.
There are consequences. So we logged into My Tribe to see how our civilization had grown over a week, and they were all dead, sadly. And I had to explain this to 6 to 8 year old kids, which was difficult. But
what's better, they learn it from a video game than from a dead hamster. Like, where? Oops, the classroom hamster died.
Or an electrocuted rat, if we had a Skinner box.
Right.
So
the tycoon style Facebook games are also good for using that. I know that usually Facebook games in general, I get bored really quickly. I haven't played in months, but I remember the first time I played Frontierville just to see. At the time, I'd read an article about how it was the leading edge of Facebook games at the time. So I tried it and I got bored for a couple of weeks and then I stopped playing. Then, I became curious and I logged in a couple of weeks later or whatever, and I had already been bored, so there was a reason why I'd stopped playing. And when I logged in and saw my property overgrown with weeds and stuff like that, I said, F you, Farmville, and I uninstalled it. And uninstalled it as far as Facebook is concerned or whatever. But it's such a jerky move to do.
Yeah, it's a real testament to how much these games hook people in that you just said, I was bored for a couple of weeks and then I stopped playing. Like, you kept playing long after you were really not all that interested because they create this, you know, you think, ooh, I can't let my crops just wither and die.
Exactly. You know,
it's the time sink version of throwing good money after bad.
Yes.
Like, I put all this time into building up my farm. It would be a shame to let it go to waste. Even though, and then you just keep investing time in it. That's why I stopped playing World of Warcraft, because it was a rat race, literally.
Right.
Yeah, Call of Duty is a bit of a rat race as well. I mean, you're just leveling up and unlocking gear and then prestiging and doing it all over again. But the advantage that I like is that every 10 minutes I have the option to stop playing. And sometimes it turns into an hour anyway, but at least I have that option every 10 minutes.
Right. We've been playing a lot of Mass Effect 3 multiplayer. That's my our go-to multiplayer in my house lately. And it's like, you know, the thing about that is if I play for 2 hours instead of 10 minutes, it's because I was having fun.
Right.
You know, but I've noticed that all the action type games and shooter games that are really popular, they've started building in these leveling things too. It used to be you went into a shooter, like a first person shooter, like Halo or something.
Right.
And your character was what your character was, and you just
everyone had the same gear, everything.
Now you go through these. I'm sorry. Now you go through these levels. Right. Right. You go level up, get more gear, get different types of guns, and you're always going, ooh, I got to play more so I can get more better guns. And then just when you finish collecting everything, they come out with an expansion pack, and now there's new stuff to collect. It's
right.
Clever.
It's not all bad, though. Like what I was saying before I derailed this with the My Tribe sad story was that video games are a great way to watch real learning happen from my experience. And maybe you guys have had the same experience even as adults. Because you have the engagement, you have the excitement, you have the willingness when something is packaged like that. And it doesn't always work, but I found video games to be a terrific teaching tool. And that's something that we are going to talk about a little bit more on the show tonight. Sydney Rock, thank you so much for your call. You want to give your website real quick?
www.gamingandliberty.com.
Excellent.
Thanks a lot, guys.
Yeah,
thank
I
you.
Look forward to hearing from you in the future, and good luck with everything. We'll talk to you soon. This
All
is
right,
School
later.
Sucks Live. Our phone is open, 843-JOIN-SSP. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to School Sucks Live. Today is August 2nd, 2012, and Corey is with me in the studio tonight. Corey, how you doing?
I'm doing all right.
I'm glad you made it.
I'm glad I made it too.
Do you want to tell people what happened or?
What happened? I don't actually remember what happened. I was, you know, just doing some reading for the show, reading up on the topics that you ended up discussing without me. And then I woke up in my bed because someone was at my door saying, hey, aren't you supposed to be on the show? When are you leaving? And this was at 9:37.
Interesting. So that's. It's not just that simple, though, because you travel. You just got back from a big trip. You travel to teach, like we talked about on the show before.
Mm-hmm.
And you were just doing a course all week. What were you doing this week?
Well, this week's course, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, was the CompTIA Security Plus certification.
That sounds hard.
I used to think it wasn't. My students always did very, very well on it with a minimum of fuss. But lately, I don't know. I don't know what's going on. I think they've made the test harder. That's the thing. These companies that, you know, these nonprofit organizations that set these certification standards, they can just change up their tests at any time and then they don't have to tell us.
Right.
So we usually find out something major changed when a class full of students fails.
It must be pretty exhausting at the end of the week because you're there. Like there is no fixed time. You're there doing this until everybody gets what they need to get. Right?
Oh, no, there's a fixed time. But that often ends up meaning, you know, if certain people take longer to be ready to take the test, we just have to cram it all into however much time. So the more difficulty a class has with a topic, the longer the days are. You know, like I just finished basically an 11-day work week. I had two classes. One was 7 days long and one was 3 days long. Plus, you know, actually it's more like a 12-day week when you consider I've got a day of travel on either side of it.
Right.
But, so yeah, we'll have a very tight schedule for classes. You know, we'll learn three entire certification courses in a week, which most people will take a semester to do one of those.
Do you meet a lot of interesting people? Do you like what's your general assessment? I know this is kind of a difficult question, but do you have like a general assessment of the kind of student that you have or their level of engagement, their level of enthusiasm? I mean, how do you think you're doing as a facilitator?
I think I'm doing as well as can be expected under certain circumstances. I mean, most of the time it's a joy. People are there. They're eager to learn. They're willing to learn because their job depends on it. You know, most of these, and if I could make one generalization about my students, is that they mostly work for the government, as it turns out. I've been doing sort of an informal poll as we go by asking all my students as we get to know each other on day one who they work for. And I would say 90% of my students work for the Department of Defense in some way, shape, or form.
Oh, yeah.
So that's sort of something I've been wrestling with these past few months.
Yeah, yeah, understandable.
But I mean, I've noticed the trend I've definitely noticed is that the younger a student is, the less they care about actually doing anything. And then they sort of expect to be able to do nothing and still do well is the most interesting part. People who are, you know, in their 40s, 30s, 40s, 50s, they know that, you know, they seem to know more that they have to, you know, they're really going to have to put in the work if they expect to get through this and get whatever benefit for their job, because a lot of their jobs do depend on it. If you work for the Department of Defense, whether you're in the military or you work for a contractor like, say, Northrop Grumman, that has Department of Defense contracts, you have to have certain certifications if you want to work on those projects with computers. Like this security certification is one of them. So people, a lot of the times, you know, their livelihood will depend on it because they can't keep their job if they don't get that certification. So they buckle down and they do the work. And I've seen people who have no background in computers whatsoever come in and do well. But these kids come in and they expect, if they're around 19, 20, they always seem to expect that they're going to be able to get away with not doing any studying or anything, or even paying attention in class. They're always Facebooking.
Yeah, and they've never been immersed in the reality of the real world, the career world, where right. These other people know. I mean, depending on what sector of the government you're in, there might be varying levels of difficulty when it comes to, you know, how do you lose your job?
Right.
And we do see, obviously, that sucks some of the incentives out if people can't lose their job.
Right.
For sure. But I work in education, too, as people know, and I deal most of the time with people who are about 16 or 17. And I had kind of a sad thing happen today. I was just wrapping up an SAT class. So we do my company in the summer, we do this 1 week and we call it the SAT camp.
Mm-hmm.
So we do SAT and then we roast marshmallows and we hike. I don't know why it's called the camp.
I don't know. No, well, the company I work for has camp in the name. And they always describe the courses I teach as boot camp style courses.
Oh, training camp. That's the
training camp. Yeah. Yeah.
So we just call it the camp because it's summer.
Yeah, because it's summer and you're roasting marshmallows. Or you're not actually roasting marshmallows. You made that part up, didn't you?
No, it's exactly like the class we do during the regular year, except it's in the summer and we call it a camp.
Okay.
All right. So it's been going on all week. And we just finished up today, and we're doing the critical reading part of the SAT, which if it's been a while for you, or if you're in another country and you've never done this, the critical reading part of the SAT is vocabulary, but it's also these passages that you have to read mm-hmm. and answer questions about them.
Right.
And I'm all into modeling active reading, the attitude that no matter what I read, there's something to learn from this passage. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the passages in these SAT practice tests are fascinating. I've clipped things out of there before. Back when I was teaching history, I'd find an interesting story about some historical topic and I'd pull it out of there so I could share it with my students because I thought it was so cool. So today we're doing this, and this passage starts out and it's talking about the Andromeda galaxy, which is 2 million light years away. And it starts talking about that length of time. And the author gets into the prospects of time travel in the future. Mm. And eventually he mentions time travel paradoxes. And I get very excited. I think this is the coolest thing. So my excitement is visual.
You're a very expressive person when you're excited about something.
Sure. I talk with my hands.
Sure.
Make gestures. Yeah. And, I'm explaining to them. I said, does anyone know what the time travel paradox is? And they just look at me. And I mean, they were pleasant kids. They're always nice kids and they're always polite. But, I don't want to be a cynic, but it seems to me like they always just kind of sort me into the same category of adult
right.
that they deal with in school. And I feel like I'm not making the most of that time that I can spend with them because they have a preconceived attitude about who I am and what I'm trying to do. And it's burdensome to them, even though the class is completely voluntary.
Mm-hmm. When you're a teenager taking an SAT course, it's not necessarily voluntary. Probably your parents are making you do it. But I would wonder if it's so much about them lumping you in with their teachers and lumping all classroom type activities in with school.
Right.
You know what I mean? They're not in their mind separating this. This just dawned on me that this is probably what's going on with my younger students. Like, you put them in a classroom and ask them to learn something and they flash back to high school and something shuts off in their mind.
Well, I think there's a very easy way to sort things, right? Mm-hmm. Just for a basic sorting procedure, we could call things voluntary and not voluntary.
Right.
Things that are voluntary are exciting, we're willing, we're enthusiastic. Things that are not voluntary suck.
Yes.
So, if this goes into the category for your students or mine as not voluntary, it seems like they already have this prepackaged mindset and attitude mm-hmm. that they bring to that situation, which is understandable. So, I'm getting all excited about time travel paradox. And I mean, if you're not familiar with what that is, like, here's the situation. You go back in time. You meet your parents, Marty McFly style.
Right.
You stop them from meeting.
Right.
The moment that happens, you should cease to exist, which means your parents will meet, which means you will exist, which means you can go back in time, stop them from meeting, which means you immediately stop existing, and so on and so forth until your head explodes.
Right. And if you were never born, then how could you go back and prevent your own birth? And that's the paradox, right?
Exactly. So in Back to the Future, so the movie is not 17 minutes long, they find a way of dealing with this.
Where, they also make it not happen instantaneously.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
Marty is given a window of time to, now I think this is like the most exciting subjects. The kids didn't. And we're going to talk about this and we'll see where this takes us in hour two of the show. This is School Sucks Live. This is Brett. I'm here with Corey tonight. We can take your calls, 843, join SSP. This is School Sucks Live. We will be back with more. Hey, everybody, and welcome back to School Sucks Live. This is Brett. I'm here with Corey.
Good evening.
And we've had a potpourri.
Sure.
We've been...
That's what they call the category on Jeopardy that might have questions about anything.
Yes.
So I think that's perfectly acceptable.
Oh, remember those Saturday Night Live skits with Sean Connery?
I'll take George for 400, Alex.
843, join SSP. We're going to hold off on the phone just for one segment so we can cover some material here. I had a general thrust for the show tonight. You know how that goes. Laurette Lynn was actually supposed to be on with us. She wasn't feeling well at the last moment, so she stepped out for tonight, and she will probably join us in a couple of weeks. And if you're just joining us now for our second hour of School Sucks Live, in the last story I was talking a little bit about some of my frustrations, some of the things that make me sad about what I do for work, and this SAT class that I teach. And I got very, very excited today about what we were doing. We were covering... just doing critical reading stuff, and I found this passage that was really exciting about time travel paradox. So I have this very enthusiastic reaction to it, and I look out at my group of students. There was six in the class. And the two looks, again, not trying to be a cynic, that I felt like I got back. First of all, no real interest in this subject that I found was fascinating, which was sad, but was, what's wrong with you, number one. And number two, is this going to be on the test?
Yes.
Almost like some anxiety about, like, how long is he going to go on with this? You know, because this is certainly, now there's not going to be time travel paradox on the SAT.
Right.
So if I just stepped out of what we were doing for 3 minutes, the fact that there was no engagement. There was no interest. There was no curiosity there. And like I said, it was a fine group of kids, but this is something that I find again and again in these classes with these 16 and 17 year olds. And the sad thing is that, you know, in 10 hours, no matter what I do, I know that there is not too much that I can do to change the direction of the momentum, you know, of 15,000 hours of government school.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Definitely not.
So this is something that I've talked about before as far as my profession was concerned. I used to be an actual classroom teacher, and the first time that I was encountering a lot of young people, they were 15, 16, 17, 18 years old sometimes. Mm-hmm. And it was hard for me, because I always felt like I was getting them right at the end, and who they were with respect to their attitudes about learning, their curiosity, their enthusiasm was formed beyond, you know, me being able to put any kind of a dent in it at all. So, of course, the impact of schooling doesn't require years and years and years like that to be palpable, because I also, over the course of the last year, worked with this 8-year-old boy who was kind of scarred from his experience in just 2 years of public school, absolutely so resistant to doing any kind of math because it was forced upon him,
right,
in school, and he really just didn't want anything to do with it. So it can happen very, very quickly too. And one of the questions that I get a lot from parents is, I want to take my kids out of school, or I've just taken my kids out of school. This is a question I've fielded several times. They don't want to do anything, you know, or what if they don't want to do anything? What should I do? And I feel like school is such a wound that, and we exist in this paradigm, we exist again in this box where that's the way it is, that's the norm.
Right.
So when you're venturing into this alternative or out of the mainstream territory, there's all of this apprehension about it.
Right, and there's limited resources and for which with which to find out how to handle it.
How do you mean?
Like, there's not, you've got the entire world, well, not the entire, but your entire world, in which everybody knows that this is how it's done.
Yeah.
And so when you try to start doing it a different way, it's difficult to figure out where to get support and advice about that.
Because, sure.
You know, I mean, there are resources out there to be certain, and there are excellent resources out there, but I would, if I were, you know, looking for some information about stuff like that, I'd be very cautious, because I think there are people out there who believe that this is a good idea, but who are also crazy. And those are the, you know, those people can make websites too.
Yeah, that's a good point as far as the whole home education thing.
Right, right, yeah. Exactly.
Laurette was saying, Laurette Lynn of the Unplugged Mom, who's a fantastic resource for all of this stuff,
mm-hmm.
was telling me that she was drawing criticism recently for being too out in the open about this, being too radical to have a website and a blog and a podcast, a radio show talking about home education and the destructive impact of institutionalized forced schooling. And one of the criticisms that she was receiving from multiple people was like, hey, you know, we're doing our own thing in, you know, our own quiet way.
Right.
And you're going to draw all this attention to it and ruin it. You know, so I think that's really frustrating when you put all the work into doing something like this and then you're told that it's more of a bad than a good. And I don't agree with that
by
at
the
all.
People who believe that it's necessary like you do. There are people, I mean, if I hear you right. She's
yeah.
getting this criticism from people who are also unschooling or homeschooling their children.
Yeah. And don't like, this like, is our thing. We don't need everybody to do this. Just don't put a spotlight on this. It's not a good, and I understand there might be a little bit of paranoia there.
Oh, yeah. The worst part of that whole thing is that I think that's a relatively reasonable reaction.
Yeah.
Like when, we're doing something good here. And if, you know, if they find out, if, capital T, they find out about it, they're going to take it away from us.
Exactly.
If you draw too much attention to us, they'll swoop in and they'll start regulating us too, which is already happening.
Yeah. So, I mean, it is hard to escape this paradigm, this way of thinking, this trap of control of schooling for everybody. And I think it's particularly difficult for people who are new to this.
Mm.
And there's this anxiety when a child first comes out of school or is about to come out of school. And they might not even be using words like unschooling or deschooling. They might just say, I'm going to teach them at home.
Right.
So there's an entire language. There's an entire mindset that needs to change. And I think when this question comes like, what do I do as a parent? Well, you know, slow down.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what we're identifying here is that your child has been run through this process that had all of these negative impacts. That process has now been removed. So we need to look for new processes,
right,
that might not be what needs to happen. There's a wound there that needs to heal. You don't need to look for new stuff to stick in it.
Right.
You have to let it close. And you also have this natural teacher within,
mm-hmm,
you know, the curiosity that has been poisoned and suffocated, and it needs to be revived. So I think that parents who are new to this or are hesitant about this because, you know, what happens at first? What's the transition like? It's a difficult, mm-hmm, transition, you know, like,
right,
moving to a different school, moving to a different town.
And it's going to be different for every child, too.
Absolutely.
You know? And your child's just been spending years being trained that, you know, whether you want to do this or not, you're going to do it. And, you know, then nobody cares whether they want to do it or not. So I think they have to learn that, first of all, people care, you know, and hopefully this is actually the case, that people care whether they want to do something or not. And when they figure out, I think, that they are allowed to do what they want, they can choose what they want to do, they're going to find themselves interested in a lot more things than they would have expected.
Yeah. And they need to broaden their horizons.
Yes.
For want of a better phrase, right?
Well, it's like when I was in high school, yeah, I was your typical, like, I hate math,
mm-hmm,
you know, high school guy. And I was so bad that in my junior year of high school, I had an algebra class where in the fourth quarter of the fourth marking period of the year, I got a straight up zero. I didn't hand in a single homework assignment, didn't score any points on any tests. And I'll tell you I'm going to leave it as a cliffhanger and we'll finish the story after the break.
Oh, well, this is our last segment, and then we're off for a month. So everybody, just kidding. That's not a true story. We'll be back in just a couple minutes with more of Corey's story. This is School Sucks Live. Got time for your call, 843-JOIN-SSP, Skype in School Sucks Live. We will be right back. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to School Sucks Live. This is Brett, Corey, right there. And we were talking about our jobs. And then from there, our jobs got into the idea of school is not a good place. Something we've talked about on this show before.
I mean, I think I had a lot of good times in school, but I think that was accidental.
Or in spite of school.
Certainly not part of its intended purpose.
Sure. Or in spite of school.
Right.
And
or it's all part of the trick that make you keep coming back.
Exactly. So the wounds of school became the topic.
Yes.
And then that tried to transition into something that's a little bit more constructive and where I wanted the show to go tonight, which was talking about a question that I've fielded several times from parents. You know, what do I do if I've taken my child out of school and all of the habits and the mindset of school still seems to be there? Or I'm really apprehensive about doing this. You know, what can I do? And my big thing is get out of the way, first of all, and give that student time. Oh, listen to me. I made a mistake that I was just about to warn you about. You have to, broaden your horizons.
Right.
So school is kind of this thought trap that people get into. School has a language. School has an attitude. And all of that stuff needs to go. Stop using the word teaching. You know, when talking about what you want your child to learn, just start using the word learning. Stop using words like subjects and pace and level. You know, I mean, that's school's language. And, you know, language has a way of becoming thoughts and thoughts have a way of becoming actions. So the more you can break away from all of that stuff in your own thinking as a parent, I think the better environment, the better future you're setting up for that child as you try to move away from school. But you have to understand that there is going to be a de-schooling and decompression period. And I've heard people say, you know, maybe it's like a month for every year of school, 2 months, 3 months for every year of school. It might take a whole year to go through the de-schooling process. And it's not just about, you know, letting the natural teacher come back to life after being suffocated. It's physical. It has to do with a person's, you know, circadian rhythms.
Right.
Even, you know, regulation of their own sleeping and eating, going to the bathroom behavior. I mean,
right.
So much of you is of your life is controlled.
I mean, I have students in my classes who like are adults who, if I don't tell them beforehand that they don't have to, will raise their hand and ask to go to the bathroom.
Oh, yeah. That happened to me yesterday. And I didn't want to be like, because I didn't want to come off as like, oh, man, it's okay. I'm a cool guy. You know, like the guy who comes to speak at the school assembly.
Right.
It's like, hey, kids.
I used to do drugs.
Yeah, they parody that on South Park a lot. You know, like I'm on your side. I'm the cool guy.
Right.
So I didn't want to sound like that. But I said, you know, if anybody needs to leave the room, you don't have to tell me where you're going, or you don't have to raise your hand.
Yeah.
You know, but that happens. That happens at least once a class.
And there's
it's
funny.
Polite.
Yeah.
I don't want to like shame somebody for that, but
right.
It certainly is a conditioned behavior that you are asking somebody that you don't even know if you can pee.
Right.
It's weird.
It's and it's funny because I remember when I went back to college. Oh, and there was this whole like a math college story that
right,
I didn't finish. The end of that story, I think I might have built it up too much. But really, what it is when I started going to college, and I didn't go to college right out of high school. I was 24 when I started my freshman year at SUNY Stony Brook, and I was going because I wanted to broaden my horizons. I thought that would be a good way to, you know, change my position in life. I was there voluntarily. I was paying for it myself out of pocket. I did take some small loans, but still, this when the situation changed and I was there voluntarily, even though they forced me to take math, I just said, well, I'm here. I knew ahead of time they were going to make me retake algebra. That's fine. And that's when I discovered I was really good at math and I enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas throughout high school and even grammar school, I was like, I hate math. I don't like math at all.
Yeah.
But then, you know, it took me getting out of school for a few years to realize that, wait a minute, this isn't stupid at all. This is fun. And I enjoy it and I'm good at it.
You do have a lot more control. I mean, don't get me wrong. Kids, college is a terrible place a lot of the time for a lot of people. Might be a wonderful place. Might be a life-changing place. College changed my life in a positive way and in negative ways. Maybe more financially or as far as the usefulness of the skills, but I learned a lot about myself and
right.
I learned a lot about what I wanted to do. But there are some bad things about college, but I think what you're saying is that there is more educational freedom in college.
Right. You get to make more choices. I mean, after you get past your first couple of years where you get all the requirements
sure.
out of the way, you have more freedom to choose what you want to study. And I think it's almost insidious that college is different from high school in ways that seem important. But aren't. It's like when you hear how much like a kid who's, you know, maybe 18 or so in their freshman year of college, when they find out that if a professor tells them that if you want to go to the bathroom, you can just go, it blows their mind. And there's also that persistent myth that they're like, if the professor is 15 minutes late, then you're allowed to leave.
Yeah.
You know, like. It's not, you know, you're allowed to leave, sure. The myth is not that you can leave if you want to. The myth is that there's a written rule that says you can leave. Like, they've been trained by school so much to say, unless there's a rule on paper that says I can leave if the professor is 15 minutes late, I can't leave the classroom otherwise. When the truth is, you can get up and walk out anytime you want, but that just doesn't fit into their paradigm of what it is in school. There must be if we're allowed to leave the room when we want, then there must be a written rule that covers it.
Right.
You know, because this is school.
Yeah.
This isn't playtime.
But that's more behavioral, but this is
right.
mental, physiological, even. I mean, if you think about how much time, depending on how long somebody spent in school, when they're actually pulled out, I mean, when was the last time,
right.
if ever in their lives, that they had, you know, the deciding role, the determining role in their own course of action.
Right.
Or even the acknowledgement of their own volition. So that's why I think we see some of these things in young adults and adults. And when a child comes out of school, there's going to need to be a real decompression and resetting of that. Right. And I mean, I'd like to see people get their kids out of school as soon as they can. The longer they've been in school, the harder this is going to be for them to do.
There may also be a factor of, and I experienced this when I changed from my previous, like, regular 5 days a week, 9-to-5 job to working in the job I have now.
Yeah.
So my job, I may have a 10-day work week, but I'll probably have a 14-day weekend at some point shortly after that. I've got a lot of time on my hands. And when you end up suddenly with a lot more time on your hands than you used to have, there is an adjustment period because you don't want to do anything. There's this weird reflex of, well, I don't have to do anything, so damn it, I'm not gonna.
So this is School Sucks Live. We can take your call on this subject. We've got plenty of time left. 843, join SSP. We will be right back. Hey, everybody, and welcome back to School Sucks Live. This is Brett. I'm sitting here tonight with Corey.
Hello.
We've had a variety of topics on the show, but we have, I think, found some direction at this point.
I think so.
And like I said earlier, we were supposed to have Laurette Lynn on tonight, and we were going to talk about de-schooling, the language of schooling, the mindset of schooling. And one thing, one very simple thing that I learned from Laurette, she's a very valuable resource. Her website is unplugmom.com, is that we don't need to use a term like unschooling or even de-schooling. I do it all the time myself.
Yeah.
Very, very common language for me. But education is a natural process, right? Schooling is not.
Schooling is totally different.
Right? So we don't need to use specialized made-up words. And it would be nice if we didn't.
Right.
And maybe someday it will be this way, to talk about a natural process like this. I think Laurette's example is, I don't do meth, but I don't call the, you know, state of me not doing meth unmething. You know?
Yeah.
So, but that is the world in which we live today.
Yeah, but the more we use words like that, it just adds more weight. Adds a little more weight to the idea that that's the norm and what we're doing is weird.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. And that's her point. And she uses home education. And this is one of the areas that we are in agreement for sure. And one of the things, like I said, that I found very valuable about Laurette's work is my whole thing with School Sucks Project is to take that word back, you know, from the schoolers who are using it today. Because they're not doing education, you know. Education is natural, and schooling is a very unnatural process. So they've hijacked that word. They've had it for a century. We want it back. We want to reclaim the definition of education for what it really is. So that's one of the missions of this show. We don't need to continue to use the words education and schooling together unless we're doing antonyms. You know, I think that learning and schooling are opposites. Learning and living are synonymous, right? So through living, we learn. And I think that this is what I was saying in a previous segment. And I'm sorry if you've, thank you for enduring our technical difficulties tonight with Ustream. I know we dropped the connection a few times and then the feed was a little choppy. I'm sorry if you missed any of what we were talking about, but that language definitely needs to go. We need to get out of that whole mindset.
Because they're manipulating the language to make it seem like they're doing something beneficial to us. And, you know, when our language is a reaction to their language, it's, you know, it, like I said, it lends them some kind of extra legitimacy.
Yeah. And it also reminds me of, I heard Stefan Molyneux give a great talk at Porkfest a couple of years ago. It was called Language is the Most Successful Government Program. And how people's beliefs and actions are shaped so much by just what their perception of certain words is. And he gave all these examples of defense and social security. And I think learning and teaching all of this language of school is something that we really need to be cognizant of and we really need to let go of. Because I will tell you, I have watched a you know, enthusiastic and curious and willing 8-year-old boy learn more in 10 minutes than I could teach a group of high schoolers in a week, you know, and that's the difference. You know, like teaching is kind of, if the person isn't unwilling, like we just say teacher, teaching, the teaching profession, noble, and it's never really looked into more than that.
Right.
But almost all the time that it's used, and this goes back to our associations, like your students might come into your class, my students might come into my class with a preconceived notion of the experience that right. they are going to have with you or me based on previous experience. Well, teaching is a very negative word as far as associations are concerned, considering what most of us have experienced throughout our entire lives. So it was one suggestion that I saw on a blog. I don't remember the name of it, but I'll find it. I'll put a link to the show notes. Take out that word teaching when you're talking about your own child and start putting in that word learning, right? Make it about them. You're just there as an observer, a facilitator, a guide if necessary, a cheerleader. You don't got to do anything except step aside and be supportive. I mean, during the initial process, and be patient. It will require patience when a child comes out of school, and it might be a couple months before they even want to do anything, you know?
I can see that. I mean, that makes perfect sense to suddenly have, like, you know, a summer vacation in the middle of the year. You wouldn't want to do anything. Wait, no one's making me do anything? Yeah. I'm going to do nothing. I think that's a perfectly natural reaction for even an adult to have if they suddenly didn't have to go to work every day.
Yeah. Oh, it happens to me. And you and I have similar types of routines, too,
right.
where you'll work very intensely for like 10 days. Maybe sometimes it'll be like 18 out of 20 days. But then sometimes you might have 2 or 3 weeks, right?
Right.
Where you don't have to work at all. And my schedule doesn't go to that extremes. Like my work is never that intense and I'm never with nothing to do for a week. And plus with the show, I mean, but that's a different kind of thing. It doesn't require travel, which is another
right.
source of stress and, you know, leading to exhaustion and frustration and all that. But, yeah, it's real easy when suddenly there's nothing to do.
Right.
And all of that stress is gone. Yeah, we look for that relaxation.
Like, I remember, you know, sometimes when I'm working, or I remember actually very clearly, like, my being in high school and going, yeah, you know, if all my time wasn't taken up with high school, I would just fantasize about all the things I'd rather be doing. And then all of a sudden, when it doesn't exist anymore, when I don't have to get up and do stuff, do what other people tell me, you know, all that stuff I thought I'd rather be doing, none of it gets done. I just do nothing instead.
It is nice once in a while. And it would be, yeah. I always dream of having this kind of schedule that is balanced, right? So it's just like there's this ebb and flow that's natural of productivity and relaxation.
Right.
But it's something that, you know, I'm really trying to work on in my life right now, where it's either like extreme productivity, and unfortunately sometimes the stress that comes with that, and over relaxation. So it's hard
right.
to find that balance. I think that's something that takes a lot of work. I mean, I'm only 34.
Yeah, so. I personally err on the side of over relaxation.
It is nice.
And I'm projecting that onto our audience and saying that that's what we all do.
Yeah, I think that a lot of people just have these lives that kind of move at a steady pace too. Like if you're subjected, and I don't want to say subjected, but you have to schedule things around your kids' routines.
Right.
The routines of a wife, the routines of a 40-hour a week job.
Right.
Like I always kind of was envious of that, of like knowing what was going to happen every day.
Right.
But I know after I did it for 2 weeks, that I would hate it. But I like, in life of just the day to day stuff that needs to be done, I would like predictability.
Right.
But
well, also, I think most people don't end up hating that predictability because we've been pretty well trained by school to like, well, you know, this is going to happen every day. And if you don't like it, you just got to do it anyway.
Oh, sure.
So, yeah. so I think generally people are trained to deal with that sort of routine. I mean, that's kind of the point, really.
Oh, yeah, you know? Definitely. Absolutely. So, before we move beyond this topic, I wanted to talk about some of my own experience as a teacher as well. Because the other part of the question that I got from parents is, how do we get that curiosity back, you know, that's been crushed? We actually just talked about this on a show that I did on Complete Liberty recently about religion, another thief when it comes to curiosity. Mm. We'll talk about that in a minute. This is School Sucks Live. We'll be right back. Hey, everybody. This is Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks Live. Corey is here with me tonight. This is our last segment of the regular show. We're going to do more show on Ustream only after this. So if you're listening to us on LRN and you say, oh, I like this show, you can check us out at schoolsucksproject.com/live. We do something called the After School Sucks Special, and that can be anything. But tonight we might keep going in a similar direction that we've been on so far tonight, even though we have visited a variety of places. Before we move any further, I did want to check in with the chat. And one of the people in the chat was saying that they just finished summer school today. They write, your day is planned for you 5 days a week, 10 months out of the year. And when we go back to like the reset, like the, just the behavioral impact, the psychological impact, the disruption to a person's natural rhythms, even their circadian rhythms, you know, that's a difficult situation to break out of, especially if it goes on for 12 years. I mean, Hopefully parents can,
and not just for 12 years, but 12 of the most formative years of your life.
Yeah.
You know.
So he goes on to say, I wish my parents had asked that question. And that was the question that we dealt with in the last segment. How can I help reinvigorate my child's lost? We shouldn't say lost.
Right.
We should say crushed curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, it's more like, how can I get my kid to stop hating school?
But
it's two very different questions. Yeah.
Yeah. How can I get my kid to stop hating school? Make him stop going to it? Like, I don't know.
I like that suggestion. I find that adults, and in our, you know, social, political, religious, educational world, people are really into the wrong questions.
Mm.
You know, questions that are completely irrelevant and totally obfuscate, whatever the real issue is there. So, well, it's something that I think a parent can help with, and I think that parents of very young children who've never been in school can do things to help foster the child's natural curiosity, but there is no quick detox. There's no real rehabilitation. It's something that I think has to come back naturally. The same way your windpipe returns to its natural shape slowly after someone has choked you for a while, you know?
It's fine. I think we were talking about how parents, you know, we're talking about how parents ask, like, well, what do I do now that my kid's out of school? And it's funny because nobody, I mean, they do, I guess. People, I'm sure they do ask, what did they do before their kids were in school? You know, when your child is a toddler and there's a lot of very important learning and exploring that toddlers do. You know, and they figure things out. That's, you know, that's the, one of the most important learning periods of one's life. And parents, they may ask, what do I do in that situation? But there's a lot of, everybody's been through the same thing.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So once, whew, thank goodness that's over. The kid's in school now. Let them handle it. But if you take the kid out of school, you have to go, you also have to go back to doing things the way we naturally do them, I think, which is how it was done when they were toddlers.
And if parents understand that, I think that they would be more able to approach that situation. They don't need to, I shouldn't even use that language. Like they need to approach a situation.
Right.
But they would be more laissez-faire. and more patient about that transition. Now, when I was a teacher, I didn't know, I would say hardly anything, even though I thought I knew everything. I was a real kind of left-wing guy at the time. And I did know that school had a very negative effect on young people. So I wanted to change this. I wanted to get in there, and I found that there were ways that are completely foreign to a lot of kids who have been schooled to build curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even if it doesn't last. And I really think that this is a natural process. So you can do these artificial stimulations of it. And maybe that feeling, that artificial stimulated feeling, can lead to them wanting to go out and be exploratory again, but no guarantees.
Right.
So one of the most important things that I tried to do as a history teacher was the hook. You know, I think the hook to bring somebody in to something, you have to give them something interesting and something mysterious about it first. This is often how movies work. This is right. often how television works, right?
Right.
So learning has always been about, here's some terms to memorize, and here's some questions, some pre-reading questions, and here's an outline. But there's nothing that really grabs somebody and brings them in to that subject. So
right. And even if you ask, like, why am I supposed to care about this? And then they lie, you know, and they'll say, oh, well, you know, you'll use algebra every day of your life after you're out of school.
You won't?
Not every day.
Oh. I try to. Love algebra.
I love algebra, too. Sometimes I have to end up using algebra concepts to explain certain things in my computer classes, and people are just like, they don't know what to do. Their faces just, they look so confused.
Now, when you say, I love algebra, too, do you mean I love algebra also, or algebra 2, the second part of algebra?
I did love it.
Yeah, Algebra 2 was really interesting. Time. I love that stuff now that I'm teaching it.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's great. But yeah, the hook is important.
The hook, yes.
The other thing was the conflict. You know, that history books talk about school, and that, I mean, talk about what has happened in the country, in the world, in society, with one voice pretty much, as right. if just like a chemistry book or a math book talks about those subjects. As if there's this omniscience that will report the information to you.
Right.
So, introducing conflict of ideas, mm-hmm. difference of opinions. This is not something that's been settled. This is something that we can investigate. This is something that we can discuss.
Right.
So one of the most ridiculous things that I ever did as a teacher, was in a world history class. I started it at the beginning of time.
Okay.
So, and, you know, the development of man. And we talked about the theory of evolution, but I also talked about the idea of creation.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't just talk about the Judeo-Christian theory of creation. I introduced like 7 different ideas about how we got to be the species that we are today. And this involved the idea that aliens came here and genetically engineered us. Very right. popular theory.
Oh, yeah.
That humans are actually de-evolving from some more complex and enlightened being.
Hmm.
Which doesn't seem to make sense, at least looking at the chronology of the past 4,000 years or so.
Yeah, well, there may have been an intermarrying between the more complex alien and the less complex pre-human and... we are a hybrid.
Or they could have inbred, and that could be us.
Oh, yeah.
But these are not things I believe. But the point was to introduce a conflict, to introduce the idea that different stories, that different theories exist.
Right.
Right? Because the truth is, it doesn't really matter
right.
if you learn about evolution or not. I mean, I think it's a helpful thing to know.
Mm-hmm.
You're probably better off for it. But we always think about, as we're checking things off as a teacher, that every single one of these competencies matters.
Right.
And it's checked off. And the student will demonstrate knowledge of this thing. But it really, if you really care about teaching, it doesn't matter at all.
Right.
None of that stuff matters. What matters is that you have a person not only who has the skills to teach themselves, but also the desire to teach themselves.
Right.
And in the shows that we've done recently, covering behaviorism, outcome-based education. I'm currently working on one about No Child Left Behind. Mm. The opposite agenda is in place,
right,
where it's just this top-down, overbearing, crushing that spirit and never giving them the skills to really learn and investigate things right for themselves. So that's what we're trying to change as we try to redefine this word.
And along with that crushing of that spirit and that will to teach yourself, it also crushes the ability to do it. People just don't know how to figure things out for themselves by the time they become adults. That's from casual observation. That's not remotely scientific, but...
But it doesn't mean that there isn't a way for everybody to learn their way out of that.
And yes,
that's what we try to do on this show. Hey, sorry about all our technical problems tonight. We'll try to have everything in ship shape for next week. I'm Brett. With me has been
Corey.
And we will be back in about 15 minutes on schoolsucksproject.com/live for the After School Sucks special. You can give us a call. Thanks for listening and take care. We'll see you next week.